That's master percussionist, composer, and band leader Tito Puente with Hot Timbales, and indeed they are. That was recorded in 1958. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. Among 13 new cases that the U.S. Supreme Court will review in its current term is Puerto Rico versus Valle. The case asks whether a person tried, acquitted, or convicted under U.S. federal law can be prosecuted for the same crime under Puerto Rico law. The case seemingly is about constitutional protections against double jeopardy, but at the heart of it is the long simmering and still unresolved issue of what is the political relationship between the United States and Puerto Rico. Well, let's tackle the first part of that question first with our guest Lyle Denniston, who is a legal historian and scholar who has been covering the U.S. Supreme Court since 1958. He is an advisor to the Philadelphia-based nonpartisan National Constitution Center on constitutional issues. And I thank you so much for being with us today.
I'm glad to be here with you today.
Thank you. Well, let's talk about this case, and in the strict terms that right in your turf, and that is about the constitutional question raised here, of that of double jeopardy. Could you tell us a bit about this case?
Well, this is a case in which prosecutors, the local prosecutors in Puerto Rico, brought charges against two men in Puerto Rico on that they were possessing a gun and ammunition without a license to have those. While those cases were pending, federal prosecutors brought virtually the same charges against each of the two men. The two men then turned around in Puerto Rico's courts and said, because we have been prosecuted by the federal government, we cannot be prosecuted for the same crimes in Puerto Rico because under the United States Constitution, there is a protection against being tried twice for the same offense. But in the background of this case is a doctrine called the dual sovereignty doctrine, which says that if the federal government and the state government are independent of each other, that is, they are each a sovereign entity, each of them can bring the same criminal charges without violating the double jeopardy. So this brings up, in this case, the question, is Puerto Rico a separate sovereign, or is it only a part of the sovereignty of the United States government because it is literally under the control of Congress for all that it does? There is, as you have already pointed out, a long simmering, in your phrase, dispute and conversation in Puerto Rico as to what is the nature of the relationship between those people and the United States government in the wake of the 1952 adoption of a constitution by the people of Puerto Rico, which made them an island country, a commonwealth within the United States government, and whether or not the commonwealth status itself determines the sovereignty is a separate question. The question in this case is, does the fact that Puerto Rico has its own constitution from which its own people derive the power to adopt laws, including criminal laws, does that make Puerto Rico a separate sovereign with its own authority, literally, to govern itself without actually being what constitutes the same as a colony of the United States Congress.
Just the same, is this a clever way of getting around the debate in Congress? Because it appears that this is going to take some time, this very question of resolving the political status of Puerto Rico. Is this a clever way, since the government is the plaintiff here, the government is bringing the case and asking the court to hear this case, is this a clever way of the government saying, of Puerto Rico saying, well, if we don't win in Congress, we surely could try something in the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, the lawyers for these two men, in replying to the government of Puerto Rico's appeal to the Supreme Court, made exactly that point. They said the Supreme Court should not get involved in this case because if it overturns the Puerto Rico Supreme Court, then that's going to suggest very strongly that Puerto Rico should have other rights as a sovereign entity, including equal representation in the Congress of the United States, which, of course, it does not now have. The Supreme Court has twice turned down, in recent years, cases from the First Circuit Court of Appeals in Boston, which is the federal appeals court that hears appeals from Puerto Rico. Their court has twice turned down cases in which the question of statehood for Puerto Rico was brought up. So these lawyers for the other side said, hold on here. If the Supreme Court takes this case and overturns the Supreme Court of Puerto Rico and declares that Puerto Rico has sovereignty, that's going to force the First Circuit to reconsider and to find that Puerto Rico has statehood. It's almost impossible to discuss the sovereignty question without getting into the political question of whether or not Puerto Rico is or should be a state or the equivalent of a state within the U.S. Polity. Even within the Puerto Rico Supreme Court decision in this case, the dissenters argued that the majority had found that the two were part of the same sovereign because the majority in this case was trying to send a signal that Puerto Rico should not have statehood. So, as I say, it appears that no one can discuss these kinds of questions without igniting all over again the question about Puerto Rican statehood.
The flip side of that coin is the politicization of the U.S. Supreme Court. By agreeing to hear this case, is the U.S. Supreme Court signaling something about itself?
Well, I take it that almost any time the Supreme Court makes a pronouncement on any subject, it reveals more of its constitutional identity. I think what attracted the court to this case is the fact that there is a direct contradiction between what the Puerto Rican Supreme Court did in this case and what the First Circuit Court of Appeals had done in a similar case. And so this is a court that believes that one of its primary functions is to clear up conflicts between lower courts that operate in the same jurisdiction. And so the court may not have had any larger ambitions in taking on this case, but that doesn't mean that once the decision emerges in this case, let's assume for the sake of the argument that a decision emerges from this case that Puerto Rico is indeed a separate sovereign for purposes of the double jeopardy clause of the Bill of Rights, that may be the scope of the decision itself. But one can imagine easily that there is going to be a lot of consequences of that in the dialogue that will continue to go on about Puerto Rico's status.
One would assume that the operative thinking here behind this petition is that the law as it is laid out and practiced in the United States, pertains to all territories of the United States. And since Puerto Rico has long been regarded, in fact, this is the big question, as a commonwealth of the United States, dependent on the United States, the assumption, therefore, is that Puerto Rico must abide by, quote, U.S. law, unquote.
Yes, well, that is an argument, but the fact is that since 1952, Puerto Rico is the one United States territory that has this unique status of commonwealth. No other territory does. Of course, the Constitution itself does make very clear that Congress has full authority to regulate the territories. But the question arises now, having conceded to Puerto Rico the right of self-government to the point of writing its own constitution that empowers its own legislature and people to pass their own laws, making them a commonwealth, does that carry with it larger implications that would diminish the authority of Congress to regulate under the Territories Clause? Because there is no question but Puerto Rico, in some sense, legally, remains a territory, but it also has this unique status as a commonwealth. And so that, of course, excites the continued conversation about, is Puerto Rico unique within the U.S. government complex, and therefore should it have a right should its government powers, its right of self-government, should that be more fully recognized? There is, by the way, following up this case, there's another case that's coming down the pike that grows out of the debt crisis in Puerto Rico. Because the government of Puerto Rico has filed a separate appeal in the Supreme Court claiming that it is being mistreated in being denied the opportunity to restructure the debt of its electric utilities. And so both of these cases are part of an emergent sense within the Puerto Rican government that its commonwealth status and the stature that goes with it should entitle it to greater recognition of its self-governing authority.
Should this case have come to the U.S. Supreme Court first rather than go through a legislative review?
Well, this is a case that involved a criminal prosecution, and therefore it was going to unfold in the courts of Puerto Rico first, and then following the decision by Puerto Rico's highest court, would then move on to the Supreme Court. So this was a case that that involved the criminal prosecution authority and not a legislative question. One presumes that the legislature in Puerto Rico can pursue its own initiatives in attempting to gain greater recognition for self-government in Puerto Rico. But this is a case that began as a criminal prosecution and continued, therefore, as a matter for the judiciary, not for the legislature.
However it turns out, the question will be about the chicken and the egg. Would the U.S. Supreme Court then be in a position of basically dictating legislative change? Would this now raise the secondary question of separation of powers? And do you expect that kind of argument to emerge from this particular case?
Well, I don't expect a separation of powers argument in this case, but there is a distinct separation of powers argument that's in the background of the debt restructuring case, because Congress has undertaken to treat Puerto Rico very differently from the other states, and that raises the question of just what power does Congress have to legislate as to an entity that has the status of a commonwealth. So that is lurking in the background of that case. I don't see a separation of powers issue in this case because it's a straightforward interpretation of the dual sovereignty doctrine in the context of double jeopardy prosecutions.
Could you walk us through, from your perspective, as how this argument is likely to be made?
Well, I think what is going to be dominant here is the question of just what did Congress intend when it gave to the people of Puerto Rico this unique status as a commonwealth? That did Congress mean to grant to the people of Puerto Rico the authority to be able to pass its own criminal laws and to enforce them with all the dignity that a self-governing part of the United States political community should have? So I think it's going to be turned on that large question rather than simply narrow questions about double jeopardy itself, because before you get to the question of whether or not the constitutional guarantee against being tried twice for the same offense, you have to deal with the question of dual sovereignty. Is this a situation involving dual sovereigns, or is this a case involving a single sovereign, which is embodied in the national government and Congress in particular, and Puerto Rico is just a dependent entity as part of that sovereignty? So I think the questions at the issue before the court are really the fundamental questions about just what is this wonderful phenomenon we have of Puerto Rico. What is it in a governmental sense? And what does it mean that it has been granted self-government of a very substantial degree?
To your mind, what is it?
Well, I guess if I were sitting on the court and had the power of decision, I guess I would say that given the fact that it has a unique status, it ought to be entitled to something of the same sort of sovereign authority that a state would have, because I think it's Congress did mean something more in the enactment of the what's called Public Law 600 in 1950 that led to the establishment of the Commonwealth and the development of its own constitution. The fact that a entity has the capacity to construct its own governmental system, to constitute itself, and which is, of course, what the United States did in 1787 in Philadelphia, the fact that an entity has the authority to constitute itself a government should, I think, raise at least serious questions about what that means in the larger sense. But it's not my position to decide this case, and I'm going to try to remain neutral throughout.
Very good decision. Very, very good decision. Do you expect that this decision, whichever way it goes, will have retroactive effect?
I would think that it probably would not have that, because the question obviously is, what did Congress mean in 1950 when it passed Public Law 600, and what happened in 1952 when Puerto Rico's adopted its own constitution? But I would not think that the court would want to go back and rearrange political or governmental structural arrangements that have been made in between times. Though I think there are clear implications in this case for the debt restructuring case that will follow on, because this case has been granted review now, That case has not been, and I suspect the court will sit on that new case until after it decides this one. But I, generally speaking, when the court makes a new constitutional decision, it does not apply it retroactively. It says that this will apply from this day forward, and I would imagine that that's the way it would work in this case. The case is probably going to be heard before the court in either January or February, and we will have a decision before the end of the term by the end of next June, I think.
Who will be watching this case? For whom will this case have particular interest, besides, of course, the people of Puerto Rico?
Well, I think the Congress of the United States is going to be deeply fascinated by it. I expect the government of the United States, executive branch, will also enter this case and take a position on the nature of Puerto Rican sovereignty. So I think this is a case that's going to attract a great deal of attention, but it's obvious that the greatest attention is going to be within the political community in Puerto Rico, because this case already has attracted a great deal of public commentary, as it unfolds in the Supreme Court, there's going to be a great deal more Puerto Rican fascination with it. But I think everybody in the national government is going to be paying rather close attention to how this unfolds.
Lyle Denniston, thank you so very much for being with us today and for giving us some insights on this legal question. And we will be following this case. Thank you so much.
Okay, you're most welcome. Call anytime.
Thank you. Well, we branch to the second part of this question, which has to do with what exactly is Puerto Rico? What is its political status? And who has an interest in keeping it just the way it is? Who has an interest in making changes? And for that, we have as our guest a wonderful professor, Victor Rodriguez, who had been with us before, professor of Chicano and Latino studies at California State University at Long Beach. And he has been doing quite a bit of work in the community along the lines of racialization of Latino identity and its impact on political behavior. He teaches courses emphasizing issues in social inequity, wealth and poverty in Latino communities, Chicano Latino politics, and on identity assimilation in Chicano and Latino life. Thank you so much, Victor, for being with us today.
Oh, good to hear from you again.
Thank you. Well, what is it? This case that we have just been discussing with Lyle Denniston concerns the question of double jeopardy, but at the heart of this case is the question of the status of Puerto Rico. Since we last talked, has that question been answered in any measure, to any clarity in your view?
No, absolutely not. And in fact, it's been an issue that has created significant conflict in terms of people that follow Puerto Rican politics. By the way, I'm not a constitutional scholar. I'm a political sociologist. But I've been following this since I was a teenager, because it's something that affects us as Puerto Ricans in a very, very intense and neuralgic way. Frankly, for me, you know, I have a completely different perspective from the one that I was just hearing, because I think that what is missing, and that's what I've been trying to do in the articles that I've been writing, is to provide a historical context. For example, just recently in Harvard University, they held a conference which was called The Insular Cases: Constitutional Experts Assess the Status of Territories Acquired in the Spanish-American War. And what I'm missing from some of the things that I've been reading about this particular case is that there is no historical legal context. Because those cases, which, by the way, were decided by the Supreme Court of the United States, by almost the same court that decided the Plessy versus Ferguson in 1996. So it gives you an idea of what were they thinking when they passed those series of decisions from 1901 all the way through 1920s. Basically, what they did is that they tried to create a what I call a parking space, a legal space, to place Puerto Rico so it would not go on what I call the process of becoming a state. Because in those days, there was a lot of preoccupation about, you know, are Puerto Ricans white? Are they not? What are we going to do with, you know, Puerto Rico was not an empty space like like California or Arizona. There were already a million people living in the island. So it was a big source of contention in Congress. So these folks, the Supreme Court, in that series of decisions, created a new category that had never been used in the history of the United States. And that category is the unincorporated territory. And you have heard me talk about this because it's just, I'm just amazed that people talk about the territory. Puerto Rico is not a territory. Territory is the first stage before a piece of land, a possession, a property acquired by the United States becomes a state. And that goes all the way back to the Northwest decisions that decided the process of what are we going to do with these new territories. So Puerto Rico was given kind of a detour from being able to go down the process of becoming a state. By the way, I think, and I'm not a constitutional scholar, I think that if the Supreme Court makes a decision, it's going to be very narrow, as much as they can, because it's going to create really a lot of controversy. For example, the Supreme Court of Puerto Rico that made that decision was stacked with conservatives by the previous pro-statehood government. And it's interesting that Cesar Miranda, who is the state attorney for Puerto Rico, is the one leading the charge against that decision because he is trying to protect the Commonwealth. He is trying to protect the Commonwealth. And obviously, for the Commonwealth, they believe that, in fact, there has been a contract or a compact. They like to say in the nature of a compact between the United States and Puerto Rico. The reality is that there is no compact. When Puerto Ricans wrote their constitution, they sent it to the Congress, and the Congress cut it, edited, eliminated some very good clauses, including the right to education. So to say that Puerto Rico has any inkling of sovereignty is not, it goes against the historical record. When President Clinton some years ago passed some laws that extended criminal cases that could be that could lead to people getting the death penalty, it was applied in Puerto Rico, despite the fact that the Puerto Rican Constitution clearly states that the people of Puerto Rico does not believe in the death penalty. So there have been a few cases in the last few years where in the federal courts in Puerto Rico, some people faced the death penalty, and fortunately, the people of Puerto Rico, the juries, did not vote in favor of that. It would have been something really colonial. They would have taken the person, put him on a plane, take him to, I don't know, to Indiana, and basically have him executed there. So those are the things that really challenge the idea that there's any issue of sovereignty. Puerto Rico has no sovereignty. It cannot even, you know, as your guest mentioned, it cannot even declare bankruptcy. So I think for me, this decision that the Supreme Court might make, it's going to be very interesting because there was a previous decision by the First Circuit Court, which, by the way, in the First Circuit, there's a person called Juan Torruella, who's a member of that court, that appeals court, and he is a pro-statehood person, and he himself agrees that Puerto Rico is a colony of the United States, which means, obviously, it has no sovereignty at all. Of course, for him, the solution is to become a state. For many of us, the solution is to have actual sovereignty as an independent nation.
So what is the impetus, you think? What is the reason for the government itself bringing this case before the U.S. Supreme Court, asking for it to review? What could be the motivation be here?
You know, again, as your guest told you, it's kind of difficult to figure out what's going on in the mind of the folks that make those decisions in the Supreme Court. I think, frankly, that it has to do with the incredible, you know, Puerto Rico is always invisible in the U.S. media, but because of the incredible economic and colonial crisis that has been, actually, it's not only the last 6 years, it's been happening since the beginning, there's been a lot of focus on Puerto Rico. And so I think they want to make some statement about it, which I have no idea what kind of statement they're going to make, because any decision that challenges what the Supreme Court of Puerto Rico says is going to be giving a lot of ammunition to the people who believe in the Commonwealth. So it because basically the people that are taking the case to the Supreme Court now is the Attorney General of the Commonwealth of the Popular Democratic Party, which is the party that created this thing that's called Commonwealth, which frankly, it's a fiction. There is no Commonwealth of Puerto Rico. In fact, there is a book that came out a few 1999 by José Trias Monge, who was the Attorney General of Puerto Rico. In fact, he was the architect of this thing that is called the Commonwealth. He himself, in his book, says that the Commonwealth is a fiction, that there was no compact between the United States and Puerto Rico. That was done because the United States was facing the incredible critique of the global community because it held a colony. And so they created this fiction to be able to get Puerto Rico out of the list of territories in the United Nations that the United States had to continue informing and reporting to the United Nations what steps was it taking to provide sovereignty to Puerto Rico. And so eventually, with the Commonwealth, they took Puerto Rico out of the list, but then eventually they put Puerto Rico back on the list. So right now, there's been a number of decisions by the Decolonization Committee basically stating the United States, what it needs to do is to give Puerto Ricans the right to choose its future and permanent political status, whether it's statehood or whether it's independence or some hybrid between that. Because all the four referendums since 1967, none of them, the United States committed itself to respect the decision of Puerto Rico. So I think it's an interesting case of this that has constitutional implication, which comes because of a criminal case. But I cannot really fathom what decision they will make. And my sense is that it's not going to mean a lot. I don't think it's going to mean a lot because it's going to raise a storm in Puerto Rico.
Well, Commonwealth, statehood, independence, how have these different political mindsets and ideologies played out in fracturing a solid, unified voice in Puerto Rico that it needs to be, it certainly does not need to be a U.S. colony anymore?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the problem is, you're absolutely right. That has divided Puerto Rico. But it's not divided Puerto Rico because we cannot make up our minds. It has divided Puerto Rico because Puerto Ricans have never had the opportunity of defining the categories. Okay, what does statehood mean? What does independence mean? Is there going to be a transition period like the Philippines? The Philippines, there was a transition period before the Philippines became independent. In none of the four referendums, which I call them surveys because they were not in any way a referendum in the sense of being able to decide the future status of the island. In none of them there was a commitment by the United States. In fact, the Commonwealth won the first two. And in that election, the people of Puerto Rico, because Commonwealth people are the majority in Puerto Rico still, had asked for more freedom, for more autonomy. And the United States didn't say anything. Congress didn't say anything. And in the last one, in 2012, the people of Puerto Rico, by a substantial majority, voted against the colonial status of Puerto Rico. In other words, they voted against the territorial status of Puerto Rico. and yet still nothing has happened. I think Obama gave a few billion of dollars to Puerto Ricans to do another referendum, but which I think is a waste of money, because until people get together in a constitutional convention, whatever it is, the mechanism to bring people together, to try to bring, to build bridges between all the different factions, nothing is going to happen. Just to give you an idea, when the people of Puerto Rico in the 1950s voted to approve the Constitution, since 1940, I think it's 1941, the Popular Democratic Party, the party who supports Commonwealth, passed a muscle law. That muscle law basically did not allow Puerto Ricans to wave the Puerto Rican flag, to sing the Puerto Rican national anthem. You could not talk about independence. So that is the kind of historical context in which people voted. And also in 1950, the nationalists engaged in an armed rebellion against the United States. A couple of towns were even bombarded by U.S. Air Force, which is something that most Americans don't know. In fact, the world doesn't know. And that is the environment in which people voted. And I think that obviously they felt that this at least was a way out, which it hasn't been, because we're in the same place we were since the 1950s.
Just the same, the situation within Puerto Rico on this question might be chaotic, but it has been very, very productive and lucrative for interests based outside of Puerto Rico, principally on Wall Street, yep. Which now is, Puerto Rico is now dealing with an onerous debt. And even though it is about $80 billion in debt, again, Wall Street is very, very pleased about the prospects of profit making. So could you talk a bit about that and how this question, this unresolved question of Puerto Rico's political status plays into this control, the financial control of Puerto Rico?
Yeah. Well, there's two, I would say, hemorrhage of funds and resources coming out of Puerto Rico. One of them is that there is still, they're called foreign corporations in Puerto Rico, that are still extracting profit from Puerto Rico, pharmaceuticals and those kinds of companies. Last year, almost $36 billion. And then you add this incredible debt to bondholders and municipal, I mean, all that kind of stuff. So the reality is that the economy of Puerto Rico is being drained. And in addition to that, more than 300,000 people have left the island. So the island is now weaker economically. It has an aging population, which basically means they will never, ever be able to pay that debt. And just to give you an example of how these hedge funds are, some of the bondholders, when the government said that they could not pay those, it didn't go in default, but they didn't pay the money that they were supposed to pay at one point, August 1. This is what they said, the bondholders. But you're still providing free university education to every qualifying student and paying operating expenses. That money is owed to us. So basically, the only way Puerto Rico is going to pay that is by, because it doesn't have any sovereignty, is by closing schools, eliminating university access to people, which, by the way, is the only good thing that Puerto Rico has. Puerto Rico has a very highly educated labor force. So even that would collapse if Puerto Rico is forced to pay the debt. I don't think it's going to happen, but then I'm an optimist. But that happens because Puerto Rico doesn't have any powers. And as you know, we have a representative in Congress that has voice, not vote. In fact, he has passed a few measures, and he gets maybe 25, 30 people that support him, but nothing has happened.
Which brings me to this question about, we are in the midst of the early start of the 2016 presidential campaign. Yeah. One would imagine that given the propensity of Puerto Ricans to vote Democratic, if not from the Republicans on this question, we certainly should have been hearing a lot about Puerto Rico and its status from the Democratic side. Are we hearing that much from the Democratic side?
Absolutely not. Basically, what has happened is that a few of the candidates, especially the Democratic and Marco Rubio, went to Puerto Rico and didn't say anything. Just because he's Latino doesn't mean that he understands the complexities of Puerto Rico's political situation. But all that they have said is, yes, I support the decision of Puerto Rico. But then they have been there to do fundraising. But nobody has done anything except take some money for their PACs or for their campaign, but nothing concrete has been said about the status of Puerto Rico, because no one wants to touch that. On the one side, I think there's a lot of fear that many Puerto Ricans might vote for statehood, and there's a lot of folks that don't want statehood for Puerto Rico for the same reason that they didn't want it at the beginning of the 20th century. And also because, on the other hand, there is a close relationship, for the most part, between the Popular Democratic Party, which is the party in power now, which is led by the governor of Puerto Rico, García Padilla. They have a good relationship with the Democrats. But not even that good relationship has led them to do anything, because the Popular Democratic Party doesn't seem to know what they want to do. Their fear is that the pro-statehood party will be reelected again, because this debt crisis has turned a lot of people against the governing party right now. There are strikes that are being called, general strikes. I mean, students are up in arms, going to be up in arms. So the reality is that Commonwealth people are not going to do anything, because they don't want to do anything that might give the opportunity to the new Progressive Party, the pro-statehood party, to be, you know, to find itself reelected to government. Because I think right now the Popular Democratic Party is very, very, very weak at this point. I'm sure if there's elections tomorrow, the new Progressive Party would win again. And that sends shudders to Congress, because they would never consider offering statehood to Puerto Rico.
So does this case, in the meantime, serve as a kind of lightning rod for these very different interest groups to start galvanizing their political support and to engage in reaching out to constituencies they think they can bring into their fold, if only about this question about Puerto Rico's future?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that the fact that the Attorney General of Puerto Rico, which is a member of the Popular Democratic Party, a supporter of the Commonwealth, took and led this case and asked for a certiorari writ is because they are trying to protect what I call the Commonwealth myth. Because if that myth falls, basically the Popular Democratic Party is going to be without content, without an identity, a clear identity. And that might give rise to pro-statehood, but I think what is also happening on the left is that there is a lot of efforts to unite people on the left, because the left is as fragmented as the entire Puerto Rican society is today. As a matter of fact, on October 14, in the state of Florida, there is a national agenda meeting of Puerto Ricans in the diaspora to talk about these issues. So they're going to...
Are you there?
Yeah, I just heard
something. I just heard, so they're going to, and I didn't hear the rest.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just thought I heard some voices in the background. On October 14, in Orlando, Florida, which is the center of the Puerto Rican diaspora today, it's not New York, it's Florida, there's going to be all the three Puerto Rican congressmen, Serrano, Velasquez, and Gutierrez, they will all be there, and leaders of the major Puerto Rican organization are going to meet to talk about the issue of the debt, and by extension, they will talk about the issue of the status, because you cannot talk about the debt without the status.
What leverage are Puerto Ricans living stateside here in the United States, what leverage are they exercising, and what influence do they have on this whole thing, this whole question?
Yeah. You know, I think that the organizers of this event were very strategic because they organized it, not in New York, but in Florida, which is a state that, you know, has always been important to determine who the next president is. And it's interesting because Florida used to be a very safe place for Republicans, but since there are more than 1 million Puerto Ricans who vote Democratic, it's now a state that very likely will be the state that decides who is going to be, first of all, not only the next president, but also who's going to be the next Democratic candidate. Because it's interesting because Puerto Ricans in Florida, because they have a lot of folks that have just returned from the island, migrated from the island, and Puerto Rico has almost a 75%, 80% participation rate in the election. Puerto Ricans like to vote.
I'm not hearing you, Victor.
Yeah, I'm just hearing someone talking in the background. You,
okay.
You hear it?
I'm just listening to you, but I didn't okay. hear the last sentence.
Well, anyway, Puerto Ricans in Puerto Rico have a very high rate participation, electoral participation rate. So when they come to Florida, they also carry a lot of that interest in politics. Not the same, because when people migrate, they kind of become disconnected and they don't know the electoral climate. But what that means is that Puerto Ricans in the state of Florida, and also the young Cubans who are no longer into Republican politics, because young Cubans are Democrats, they're going to determine in many ways who the next president is. But unfortunately, the Democrats are not doing anything to avail themselves to galvanize that community. And it might be that there might be a protest vote, because people feel in the diaspora that the Democratic Party is not responding to the needs of Puerto Rico, which is why this convention is taking place on October 14. And I wish I could have been there, because it's going to be very, very important.
Not even Hillary Clinton? Not even Bernie Sanders?
Well, Bernie, you know, basically what happens is that Bernie just selected his Latino coordinator, I mean, outreach coordinator. And Hillary has, you know, gone back and forth, and yes, she supports Puerto Rico's decision, but the reality is that not even Bernie Sanders, who I really respect and like, has been able to make a strong statement. And the statement needs to be, no, we're going to give you state or no. The statement needs to be, we want to give you, the people of Puerto Rico, the opportunity to select your own future. By the way, I'm going to have to end in a couple of minutes.
Sure. I just want to ask you one more question, and that
okay.
is, should Puerto Rico become a symbolic example of the hypocrisy of the United States, that here is a country touting its democratic ideals all over the world, so, and yet Puerto Rico is its colony?
Yep. Absolutely. In fact, one of the things that I have written is that after the war, the Spanish-American, Cuban-Spanish-American War, the United States, before that, was doing nation building. After 1898, the United States has been doing empire building and has acquired colonies, which goes against the grain of everything that I learned about the democratic values of the United States. Because democratic nations don't have colonies. Empires have colonies. So that's the challenge that the United States has, which is why, by the way, a lot of people don't even want to touch the subject, because it's going to reveal this very, very putrid history. By the way, I just want to let you know that there is a book that just came out 3 months ago by Nelson Dennis. I think you should have him in your program. It's called The War Against All Puerto Ricans. It's published by Nation Books, and it is an incredibly well-researched, well-written. In fact, not many history books of Puerto Rico become bestsellers, and it's been a bestseller in Amazon.com for the last seven weeks. And also in Puerto Rico, in Barnes & Noble and all the bookstores and libraries, is becoming a bestseller, despite the fact that it's written in English. And on November 24th comes a version in Spanish, which is going to be distributed throughout Latin America. So that's going to raise a lot of interest in what happens in Puerto Rico, because Latin America has always, the majority of Latin American countries, have supported Puerto Rico's right to self-determination. And in fact, the way they talk about it, like they did in the Summit of the Americas in Panama, where President Obama was, what they said is Puerto Rico has to return to the community of Latin American nations. But that Victor, usually is not covered in the media.
Victor Rodriguez, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. A great, great storehouse of knowledge and information about Puerto Rico. And we will be following this case. And yep. I would like you to come back real soon, and we'll do a very special program on Puerto Rico.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, that brings us to the end of our program today. And you think things are really just isolated, you know, but they are all connected. That's what I keep talking about, systems. They are systems of governance. And you see how a case that looks like a criminal case, that talks about the constitutional question of double jeopardy, but it really is about determining the status of a nation. And they don't seem to be linked, but they very much are. And we heard from Lyle Denniston today about the complexities of the arguments that are to be expected at the U.S. Supreme Court, which will dance around this question very gingerly, because however it rules, it will determine a very, very highly politicized course in the immediate future. And we heard from Professor Rodriguez a bit of history in just condensed fashion, just a short interview that we did today. I'm sure that you gleaned some information about Puerto Rico you didn't know or didn't think about. So we put these things together so that you have a base of knowledge and that you can operate from to make sense of all of this that is happening around us. So that is why we engage in these kinds of discussions. I want to thank you so much for joining me. I want to encourage you to stay tuned to PRN.FM. Coming up next, Infectious Myth with David Crow. I was going to do a special commentary today, but it will take some time, more time than I had allotted today, but it was important to hear what Victor Rodriguez and Lyle Denniston had to say. So I'll do that commentary tomorrow. What I will do in that commentary is reveal that the city of Ferguson is being targeted for forced bankruptcy. And it is an interesting and methodical way in which they're going about pile driving Ferguson into the ground. Is this the ultimate payback for the protests around the killing of Michael Brown? We don't know. But we do know that systems behave very predictably because they are practicing the science, and I use that word, the science of white supremacy. And so in many, many ways, while they do dastardly things, they're very predictable in their behavior. And in the same way that we see what happened in Detroit, what has happened in Belle Isle, what has happened so many cities in Michigan that we've been talking about, Flint and others, we're seeing it happening now in Ferguson, Missouri. The city is being set up to be forced into bankruptcy, and of course all the other things that come behind that. Thanks so much for listening. A pleasure and a great privilege always to be in your company. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Bye-bye.